Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today it's Tristram Hunt on 10 cities that made an empire.
It's always good to know the treasure of travels business. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be at the Chalk Valley Literary Festival, sponsored by the Daily Mail. A newspaper, those of us in the Labour movement associate more with fiction than non-fiction, but nonetheless, we're delighted to have them. May we have the picture of the book up, please, to begin? Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, on the 30th of June 1997, after the 99-year lease on the new territories came to an end, Great Britain handed back Hong Kong to the People's Republic of China. At the stroke of midnight, the Union Jack was lowered to the strains of God Save the Queen. The Hong Kong police ripped the royal insignia from their uniforms and Red Army troops poured over the border. Steaming out of Victoria Harbour as the Royal Marines played Rule Britannia and Land of Hope and Glory on the last symbolic voyage of the Royal Yacht Britannia, Britain's last governor, former Conservative Party chairman Chris Patten, wrote, "That night we were leaving one of the greatest cities in the world, a Chinese city that was now part of China. A colony now returned to its mighty motherland in rather different shape to that in which it had become Britain's responsibility a century and a half before." In London, the atmosphere was altogether shriller. The handover of Hong Kong to China strikes many Westerners as a disgrace and a tragedy, thundered The Economist. Never before has Britain passed a colony directly to a communist regime that does not even to pretend respect conventional democratic values. The diaries of Alastair Campbell, Prime Minister Tony Blair's Director of Communications, describes the scene amongst the UK delegation preparing for the ceremonial. When someone referred to the Chinese as the Dewhursts of Peking, there was a mild laugh around the table. "I looked at Chris Patten a bit bemused. Dewhursts, as in butchers," he said. Campbell thought it all a little self-indulgent. But when he caught sight of the Chinese soldiers, he was hit by the full awfulness, as he puts it, of the handover. Then the flag came down and theirs went up and it was all pretty sick. Tony Blair hated it and it showed a little. I can't believe that we could not have kept it. In his own memoirs, Blair recalls of the ceremony, quotes, "a tug not of regret, but of nostalgia for the old British Empire." He also admits to a startling failure to appreciate the historic significance of the return of Hong Kong as a rising, newly prosperous China sought to take its place in the world and shed the memory of its century of humiliation. And there's also this extraordinary account in Tony Blair's memoirs of his flying to Hong Kong, arriving incredibly jet-lagged, and then the Chinese Prime Minister thought it would be fun to test Tony Blair's knowledge of William Shakespeare, which was not as up-to-date as it might have been. But there was one member of the British delegation keener to cling on to the past. In a confidential diary entry entitled The Great Chinese Takeaway, His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales laid bare his despair at seeing the Crown Colony returned to the mainland. Watching another piece fall from his family inheritance, the Prince lamented the ridiculous rigmarole of meeting the old waxwork Yang Zemin and the horror of watching, quotes, "an awful Soviet-style ceremony in which Chinese soldiers goose-step on the stage and haul down the Union Jack." And it's obviously so heartening that the Prince of Wales no longer makes such diplomatic gaffes. Charles Philip Arthur George Mountbatten Windsor knew all too well that when his time came to assume the throne, the loss of Hong Kong meant Britain's imperial role would be long past. "Such is the end of empire," I sighed to myself. But if the British Empire has indeed come to an end, its legacies remain nonetheless apparent all around the world. And amongst the most compelling of those phenomena still with us is the chain of former colonial cities from Dublin to Mumbai, Melbourne to New Delhi. After sporting pastimes and the English language, urbanism, in the words of Jan Morris, is arguably the most lasting of the British imperial legacies. And this imperial heritage is now being preserved and restored at a remarkable rate, as post-colonial nations debate the virtues and vices, the legacies and burdens of the British past, and how they should relate to it today. So what my new book seeks to do is explore the imperial story through the urban form. 10 cities charting the rise and fall of the British Empire and how you can tell the story of the British Empire through the architecture, through the street design, through the rituals, the fabric, the culture of these great cities. The history of these cities also exposes how the idea of imperialism changed over time. When you think about the long history of British imperialism, the rationale for empire would change through the centuries. At times we were a mercantilist empire, at times we were free trading, at times we were imposing civilization, at times we were protecting civilization. And as Joseph Conrad's Marlowe notes in Heart of Darkness, it was always an idea that had to redeem the sometimes grubby practices of empire at any one point. An idea at the back of it, not a sentimental pretense, but an idea, an unselfish belief in the idea. Something you can set up and bow down before and offer a sacrifice to. So the ambition of this book is to explain how those ideologies of empire were made flesh through the city. And also, I hope, move the debate on about our imperial past from some of the narrow definitions it has laboured under the last decade or so. Famously, in his 2003 book, Empire, How Britain Made the Modern World, the historian Neil Ferguson made a stirring and influential case for the British Empire as the handmaiden of globalisation and as a force for progress. No organisation has done more to promote the free movement of goods, capital and labour than the British Empire, he wrote. By way of contrast, an increasing body of opinion has sought to cast British imperialism as a very, very bad thing. In the words of the left-wing author Richard Gott, the rulers of the British Empire will one day be perceived to rank with the dictators of the 20th century as the authors of crimes against humanity on an infamous scale. And much of Gott's case has received official endorsement in recent years with a series of public apologies by European governments. In 2004, Germany apologised for the massacre of 65,000 Herero peoples in what is now Namibia. In 2008, Italy announced it was to pay reparations to Libya for its colonial past. And then in 2013, the United Kingdom government, having apologised for the Great Famine of the 1840s, and expressed official regret over its role in the trade in Atlantic slavery. In 2013, it was forced by a High Court judgment to announce a £20 million compensation package for 5,000 Kenyan victims of British abuse during the 1950s Kenyan emergency. But the danger now is that as the legacy of empire moves into the realms of official apologies and lawsuits and compensation settlements, the space for detached historical judgment has narrowed. What is more, as the historian Linda Colley has suggested, one of the reasons why we all need to stop approaching empire in simple good or bad thing terms and instead think intelligently and inquiringly about its many and intrinsic paradoxes is that versions of the phenomenon are still with us. And so I think it is the very complexity of the urban past, the history of the city, which allows us to go beyond some of these narrow binary definitions and think about the history of imperialism in terms of adaptation, interaction, and exchange. So what do the history of my cities reveal? I begin in Boston, on the eastern seaboard of America, where in the mid-17th century, a band of Puritan merchants and settlers sought to craft a New England to get away from the fallen crypto-Catholic Laudian world of Stuart England. They were driven both by a determination to celebrate freedom of religion, unless, of course, you're a Quaker, but also a determination to make some money out of the cod industry, the whale oil industry. And they built the city of Boston, as famously in Governor Winthrop's words, as a city on a hill, as a shining light for Puritan settlements across the world. And I love this map because here is Boston, right in the middle of this seascape. And you understand the narrowness of the line into Boston. And this would frequently be flooded. All of this was then infilled during the course of the 19th and 20th century. So when you land in Boston today, you have very little sense of this sort of nautical nature of Boston. But also the intimacy of Boston. And this was a place rich in ideas, rich in politics, rich in radicalism. This neck of land is not above 4 miles in compass, in form almost square, having on the south side at one corner a great broad hill whereon is planted a fort, which can command any ship as she sails into any harbour. And Boston begins as a Puritan settlement, but during the course of the 17th and 18th century, Boston also becomes part of an empire of goods. And the British Empire in the 17th century was an empire of exchange across the Atlantic. And what we see here in this wonderful depiction by Paul Revere in the later 18th century is the energy and vitality of the city, but also, I think, the wonderful contrast between the spires of the Congregationalist Church, the Unitarian, the Baptist, and then the spires, the masts of the ships at sea. These are actually the British ships beginning to land, and here you can see the lobster backs are landing along the Long Wharf. So Boston prospers as part of a British empire based upon commercial exchange. And the city of Boston is in many senses English as the city of York or Exeter or Norwich or Cheltenham. They had the same literature, the same customs, the same material rituals, and above all, what that meant more often than not was a cup of tea. But the problem was Boston enjoyed being part of the British Empire, but it didn't enjoy necessarily having to pay for it. It didn't enjoy having to pay for protection from the French and the Spanish. This was a very loyal city. This was a very royal city. But when the Parliament, when the British Parliament started to seek some contribution for the protection of the Royal Navy and the British Army, well, then Boston began to cut up rough. So to begin with, the British Parliament imposes money on sugar. That doesn't work. It then goes for the Stamp Act, which is about putting a tax on literature, everything from playing cards to newspapers. And here, wonderfully, this sadly isn't made in my constituency of Stoke-on-Trent. This is actually made in Derby. But it's an account of the money you can make from anti-colonialism in the heart of the colonial empire. But after sugar, after stamp, they then go, of course, for putting tax on tea. And this is an absolutely disastrous decision. And so you have the Boston Tea Party of 1773. And here you can see them pouring the tea into the sea. And when you read accounts of the time, it's almost like an oil slick. You have these tea leaves throughout the Boston Harbour going right down to Dorchester. And this is the moment. They think this is about no taxation without representation. We know this is about keeping their smuggling routes open and making quite a sizable profit on it. But Boston begins the British Empire. Boston is my first city of empire. I then move from Boston down to what goes with tea, which is, for many people, sugar. And my second city of empire is Bridgetown, Barbados. And the history of the British in the West Indies is a salutary and harsh reminder of the brutality, oppression, and racism involved in so much of the colonial project. The British became involved in sugar production from the late 1600s using techniques developed by the Dutch and the Brazilians. It was the Drax family who began the production of sugar in Barbados in the mid-1600s. And their modern representative is the Member of Parliament for Dorset South. Some of you might be his constituents. Richard Drax, who is the inheritor of this. I haven't yet told him. I've sort of crept around his family compound in Barbados. But here you see the production of sugar. So they're crushing the cane here, the sugar cane, in between the rollers. And this is sort of an old-fashioned version. They're pushing the rollers mechanically and whipping them through. In time, this would be done through windmills. The reason why Barbados would be covered in windmills was for the energy for the rollers to crush the cane. Once you've crushed the cane, the juice coming out of it then goes to the boiling room, and you're going to boil that down on your journey towards sugar and molasses, and all of it overseen by the settler with the gun, watching them bring in the sugar cane from the fields. Between 1662 and 1807, British ships carried 3.25 million Africans across the Atlantic to America and the Caribbean to work in, more often than not, the sugar industry. And in Barbados, they turned a landmass similar in size to the Isle of Wight into the one of the richest islands in the world. "The whole is a sweet spot of sugar," wrote one visitor. "Not a span hardly uncultivated with sugar canes. All sides bend with an easy declivity to the sea and is evergreen." The island was almost entirely given over to cane, with some 93% of its total exports made up of sugar, rum, and molasses. And it was exported out of Bridgetown, Barbados, down here. And here we see Governor Robinson coming down to church in Bridgetown, Barbados. Barbados is the most easterly of the Caribbean islands. So this was where the slaves touched down, and either they would then go and work in Barbados or they would then be exported to Antigua, to Jamaica, to work in it, to work in the fields. But then from Bridgetown, the goods would go out. And this is what Marx used to call primitive accumulation. So from the natural resources of Bridgetown would flow the riches of the colonial experience. And they would come back to the UK and they would build marvellous stately homes here, and they would fund the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution. And they would also crucially fund the expansion of the British Empire. The riches of colonialism in the Caribbean were essential to the development of the Royal Navy and the British Army. This is where the wealth for the further expansion of empire comes. And the reason I love this picture so much is not only here in Carlisle Bay do you get a sense of the commerce and the wealth and the exchange going on, and not only do you get the sense of a landscape given over to production, but it doesn't come out on this screen so much, but it's the Caribbean clouds, which are amongst the most beautiful elements of that picture. So Boston is the first, Bridgetown is the second. My third city of empire is part of this Atlantic empire of goods, which is the city of Dublin. Ireland, of course, was England's earliest colony. From the plantations of the late 16th century, the English and then the Scottish had settled its lands. And as such, they became a part of the Irish nation. These settlers and their descendants, the so-called Protestant ascendancy, turned the city of Dublin during the 18th century into a showcase of their civilization. As English born in Ireland, they wanted to be equal partners in empire, not troublesome colonial cousins. And in Leinster House, which is now the seat of the Irish Parliament, you have a sense of this colonial aesthetic. The Palladian style, this was actually the model, incidentally, for the White House in Washington. The Palladian style is itself drawn from the Veneto and is the style that the Protestant ascendancy would have in their plantations, a different type of plantation, in Ireland. And what is so interesting about Dublin in the mid-18th century is that they're then beginning to bring in this colonial architecture and this colonial aesthetic into the heart of Dublin. And we sometimes don't think of Dublin as a colonial or imperial city, but that's certainly how they thought of it in the 1960s when they began to destroy so much of the Georgian and 18th century past. "Georgian buildings," wrote a correspondent to the Irish Times, "are an offence to all true blue Irishmen. They are a hangover from a repressive past, and they must go." And so the ripping balls swung through the beautiful terraces and squares of Georgian Dublin as an act of post-colonial independence, that modern Ireland had to shed itself from this Georgian architecture in order to be a Gaelic nation. But the architecture of Dublin was a testament to a desire to build a sense of Britishness, a secure identity between Ireland and Britain before then they would conjoin to head out into the broader world. This is the Custom House in Dublin. And here in the middle, you have Britannia with the Union flag and Hibernia with her harp, with good consequences relating to Ireland, as it was described. And they're cuddling up here. And then you see what brings them together. It's the prosperity from trade. It's the ships coming into Dublin. It's the wealth that comes from empire. And Dublin is the great provisioner of empire. Dublin is sending wares out to America. Dublin is an export capital for the rest of the British Empire, and it grows rich on it. And this is a complicated story for modern Ireland, thinking about the role of Ireland, colonised Ireland, in the broader British imperial project. This beautiful cuddling up is then consummated in 1801 with the Act of Union. And to celebrate again the conjoining of Ireland and Britain, the architecture of Dublin becomes even more British. And at its heart is Nelson's column. And there, actually, you have the General Post Office as well, the GPO. And this has a very fascinating history in the 20th century, because at a meeting of the Dublin City Council on the 7th of December 1953, a letter was submitted by the Honourable Secretary of the IRA Dublin Brigade, enclosing a copy of a resolution adopted by the Dublin Brigade Council calling for the removal of Nelson's pillar. And it's basically the IRA saying to Dublin City Council, look, we can do this the easy way or the hard way. Either this can go through planning or we're going to knock it down. And Dublin City Council didn't act quickly enough. So in 1966, it was blown up. So Boston, Bridgetown, Dublin, that's the first empire. That's the Atlantic Empire. Britain then begins to move its focus in the late 18th century towards its second empire, towards India, and the riches from India. But to get to India, it needs to go through my fourth city, which is the city of Cape Town. The capture and control of Cape Town was fundamental to growing the global power of the Royal Navy and, crucially, securing India for the British. This was the seaport and provisioning station for the great swing to the east. Cape Town was known as the brothel and tavern of the two oceans, or more generously, the master link of connection between the western and eastern world. And this beautiful panorama by Lady Anne Barnard. Lady Anne Barnard was the wife of a slightly dim diplomat in the late 1790s, and she herself is a spectacularly intelligent, brilliant, clever woman. And here you see what they inherit, in a sense, in Cape Town, which is a Dutch city. This is Dutch Cape Town. This is a city created by the Dutch as a provisioning station for the fleets to go all the way to the East Indies, to modern Indonesia. But to avoid scurvy, to get fresh food, to get fresh water, to get fresh meat, to get lemons and oranges, they would stop in Cape Town as this provisioning station. And they built it up during the course of the 18th century. They also had the gallows. Slavery was a vital component of Dutch Cape Town. And here you actually see slaves rebuilding the walls of the fort, and here you have the Union flag. But the city itself was beautifully planned with all the sort of rigour you would expect of Dutch town planning. And here along the centre, these are the gardens which farmed the lemons and the oranges and the pomegranates and the gooseberries and everything that was needed. And they did so by trapping the waters coming down from Table Mountain. And here in the corner is the fort. And now, again, because of infilling. The line of the bay is probably about that now. A visitor in the 1780s described, "Everyone must be pleased with the town, which has all the regularity and neatness usual among the Dutch. The streets are all parallel to each other, and there is one large square with trees planted round, and a canal of water from springs running down. The houses are very good and have a neat appearance on the outside, which altogether make it a very pretty town, and some few circumstances excepted, equal in neatness to any of our seaports in England." But the thing about Cape Town was the romance of it. It was the drama of arriving in Cape Town and seeing the tablecloth sort of hovering above a Table Mountain. And there are these beautiful accounts of being so long at sea and then seeing the clouds in the distance and knowing that you were heading towards Cape Town. And here you see the fine Dutch architecture of the city. But Cape Town was fine when it was in the hands of the Dutch. It was a free port. The British could go there. The Germans could go there, the Spanish could go there, the Portuguese could go there, it was fine. But in the 1790s, revolutionary France invades Holland and then begins to think about taking control of Holland's colonies. And so, as one Royal Naval official said, what was a feather in the hands of Holland will become a sword in the hands of France. For Britain to hold on to its empire in India, it then needed to take control of Cape Town. So in the late 1790s, the British invade Cape Town. We then return it to the Dutch in a peace treaty, and we then reinvade again to take control of it. And so from the 1800s, Britain takes control of Cape Town as a colonial city, takes over from the Dutch, begins to introduce English as the language alongside fox hunting and horse racing, and Cape Town becomes a colonial city. So what was the prize which Cape Town was so determined to protect? It was, of course, the riches and prosperity which the East India Company were extracting out of Bengal. And so my next city is the wondrous city of Calcutta, the capital of British India. "Nothing could equal the magnificence of my approach to this town," wrote a visitor in the 1800s. "For nearly 3 miles, the river, which is as large as the Thames at London, is bordered by lovely, well-built country houses with porticos and colonnades. The town is a mass of suburb palaces in the same styles, with the finest fortress in the world." To the Victorian imagination, Calcutta would always be associated with the black hole of Calcutta. But what Calcutta symbolized was both the riches, particularly silk and cotton extracted from Bengal, but also, crucially, the beginnings of an imperial idea of empire as a territorial landmass, the beginnings of thinking about empire as a process of conquering large areas of land. And the man who symbolized that was Richard Wellesley, the Duke of Wellington's brother, the Governor General of India in the early 1800s, who goes out to India and uses all the money which the East India Company had been extracting to fight a series of wars, which massively expands British influence over India in the early 1800s. He was determined, as he put it, for India to be ruled from a palace, not from a counting house. And this is where you begin to see the full power of the British Empire in India from the early 1800s. And so just as the world was beginning to understand, thanks to the work of Gibbon, the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, in India, Britain was building its answer to the Roman Empire. And Wellesley was determined to have an architecture and an aesthetic which reflected that. So this is Government House, built in Calcutta, modelled on the Curzon stately house, Kedleston Hall in Derbyshire. And this is the full sort of Roman, hubristic, triumphalist model of empire. And you have these wonderful pictures of Calcutta from the early 1800s, contrasting the whiteness, the Western aesthetic, the sharp lines with the dark town of Calcutta, with the indigenous residents, as a symbol of civilization, as a symbol of Western superiority, bringing civilization to the Indian Empire. And so on the banks of the Hooghly, Wellesley inaugurated a new era of imperial might. But what funded this growing empire? Part of it was cotton and silk, but one of the most successful exports out of Calcutta came from the Bengal poppy fields. Opium, as one British missionary put it, crept in a most mysterious and fascinating manner into the homes of the rich and the poor, and with its mystic fingers gripped the hearts of old and young. Men became paralyzed before this new force, and reason stood silent, and the highest ideals of human life slowly paled and vanished in the presence of this Indian mystery. The most lucrative market for the Bengal opium was China. But China was determined not to allow the import of opium and began to close its markets to the import. And so what the British needed was a trading post. What the British needed was a station for the import of opium. And it alighted upon my next city of empire, which is, of course, the fragrant harbour, which is Hong Kong. If Cape Town was about the sea, Calcutta about land, Hong Kong was about Britain's informal empire of free trade. And here you see the Jardine Matheson warehouse for the import of empire, the go down, and then the residence at East Point. They'd had enough of having to sail their ships up against floating warehouses. They'd had enough of boxing and coxing with the Chinese authorities. So they needed their own trading point, and Hong Kong would provide that. And accounts of Hong Kong are fascinating in the mid-19th century. This is the 1840s. Because British visitors always describe Hong Kong in the same language as Scotland. That there was something about the mists. There was something about the greenery, something about the ferns, and you contrast that with the granite of the stone, and you contrast that with the deep blue sea. And this was a place of extraordinary romance and ardour for British visitors. It was also the place, crucially, for the opening up of the China trade. Soon enough, it becomes one of the busiest shipping stations in the world. After London and Liverpool, Hong Kong becomes the third port of empire by the late 19th century. And here we see the American whalers, the tea clippers, the paddle steamers between Hong Kong and Kowloon. And it was also, I mean, Kipling also describes brilliantly the intimacy of Hong Kong. The place, this was a place where terrible rows, terrible fights amongst the British community there, and it had all the atmosphere of a hill station at its most sort of divided. I move then from the fragrant harbour of Hong Kong to a much more industrial city, but again, the trade routes of opium is what guides me. And the man who takes me there is Sir Jamsit Jeejee Boy, who is the trading partner of Jardine and Matheson. And after the end of the monopoly of the East India Company, Bombay begins to get into the opium business. And it's Jeejee Boy who... It's Jeejee Boy who provides the trade routes from Bombay to Hong Kong. And Hong Kong is the first, Bombay is the first industrial city of my cities of empire. And it was the American Civil War, interestingly, which opens up Bombay as this great industrial center. because as a result of the American Civil War, the North blockades the South. The South can't get its cotton out of America to Liverpool and Manchester. So Manchester demands a new supply of cotton, and it is Bombay which provides that. And then Bombay begins to manufacture and spin its own cotton production. And it becomes this big, booming industrial city. And the accounts of Bombay in the 1860s and 1870s are very similar to the accounts of Birmingham and Glasgow in the 1830s and 1840s. And here we see the aesthetic which comes as a result of it. This is the so-called Bombay Gothic style. And this could be in Birmingham, this could be in Liverpool, this could be in Manchester. For those of you who know Bombay, I'm sure you do, you'll realise there's a problem with this photo, which is that, for reasons I've yet to work out, we flipped them. But this is the Victoria terminal. This is the great station, what Jan Morris called the central building of the British Empire. And this is the Municipal Corporation building. And it's this wonderful mix of sort of Balmoral and the Natural History Museum and sort of Gormenghast, high Gothic architecture, all of it celebrating the power and wonder and industrial enterprise of Bombay. And you see this style right across the city. This is Bombay University. And here, this could be straight from Venice. It's from Venice to Britain, back to Bombay. It's the Cadoro, designed by George Gilbert Scott, who never actually went to Bombay. You have all these architects designing for the city, but never actually going there. But my favourite design in Bombay is this fountain in the middle of Crawford Market with these very naturalistic, sort of Ruskinian touches on it. And it's designed by a man called John Lockwood Kipling. And John Lockwood Kipling taught art at the Bombay School of Art, but he learned his trade at the Burslem School of Art in Stoke-on-Trent. And he goes out to Bombay to design out there. And while he's there, his wife gives birth to a son. And so John Lockwood Kipling decides to name his son after a lake just north of Stoke-on-Trent, Lake Rudyard, which is a beauty spot in North Staffordshire. And so Rudyard Kipling grows up on the grounds of the Bombay School of Art while his father and his father's students are designing these absolutely beautiful designs. But if Bombay is an urban city and an urban industrial city, my next city takes us in a different fashion, which is the suburban aesthetic. Melbourne is this fantastic city of suburbia. And just as the British were embracing suburbia in the latter half of the 19th century, so in Melbourne, the style and aesthetic of this city stretches out through the tubes and trams into the hinterland. And the theme which I seek to explore in Melbourne is this notion of what Chamberlain called the crimson thread of kinship, the notion of a shared imperial identity basically connecting up together the white Anglo-Saxon parts of empire, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, South Africa. And you have this debate in the late 19th century about how the future of the British Empire lies in many ways not with the inner cities of Britain, where we've got terrible fears about eugenic collapse and pollution and all the rest of it, but actually in the healthy, virile young men and women of Australia and New Zealand and South Africa. You have this very fascinating debate about where actually the meaning of empire and the future of empire lies, and it begins to lie beyond Britain. It begins to lie in Greater Britain. And part of this is explored through sport. And you have this very sort of Oedipal contest between the mother country and the colonies, sort of segued through a sporting system. These are the beginnings of the celebrated test matches, as the young men of the colonies seek to prove in many ways their Englishness, seek to prove their imperial identity through sport. and all the sort of sports writers get behind it. So on one of the visiting teams, one of the commentators says, "For all that the scepter has passed away, so to speak, the flag is struck. It may console them, the British, to note that the English, interestingly, English race is not degenerating, and that in the distant land and on turf where lately the black fellow hurled his boomerang, a generation has arisen which can play the best bowlers of the time." What is so terrifying is that this language of sportsmanship then segues into the martial spirit of World War One. And the language of proving your martial virtue becomes part of the drumbeat towards the First World War. And one of the most popular poems in Australian schools at the time speaks of a team that is ready to take the field to bowling with balls of lead in a test match grim where if one appealed, the umpire might answer dead. The penultimate city in my history is the Rome of Hindustan, is New Delhi. And when you read accounts of people visiting New Delhi in the 1920s, they can barely begin to describe it. The Rome of Hindustan lies on a scorched and windswept plain, historied with tumble-down memorials of the Mohammedan conquerors. Across this plain glitters now an English Delhi, a vision of domes and towers, pink and cream against the morning blue and new green trees below. And here you see the enormity of it. This is the Viceroy's house, the Viceroy's gardens, which Gertrude Jekyll was a great inspiration. The Secretariat blocks here, the Kingsway down to the memorial, and there the council house, which is today the parliament. And all of it built in this consciously imperial style. Dome, tower, dome, tower, dome, red, pink, cream and white, washed gold and flashing in the morning sun. The traveller loses his breath and with it his apprehensions and preconceptions. Here is something not merely worthy, but whose like has never been. And what Lutyens and Baker sought to do was build a consciously imperial style. They couldn't bear the Bombay Gothic. They couldn't bear Indo-Saracenic. Lutyens had these terrible puns about, you know, they say Hindu, I say Hindon't. This was going to be a completely separate aesthetic. And yet it wasn't what we saw with Wellesley. It wasn't what we saw with Calcutta. Actually, once you begin to look at the debts, particularly to Mughal aesthetics, particularly to Fatehpur Sikri and Agra, you begin to see how Lutyens combines a sort of, his country house, West Sussex aesthetic, with the traditional Indian designs. And this was an architecture which was meant to last 1,000 years. This was an imperial architecture which proved that this was the British Empire to last forever. And famously, the bells were made of stone, so that they could never ring the end of empire. And the one person who really enjoyed walking around the building site at New Delhi was the French Prime Minister, Georges Clemenceau. And he used to wander around saying, this will be the greatest ruin of them all. But it wasn't. It wasn't a ruin, actually. It was handed over to an independent India. And what's so interesting about that is that, you know, New Delhi is a Versailles of imperialism. It is a place where hierarchy and ritual and costume is absolutely fundamental. And these extraordinary accounts of the high life in New Delhi in the 1930s. And then yet, you know, the man who wonderfully takes control, short period, but the symbolism of Churchill's half-naked fakir having tea with Mountbatten, taking on this city of empire is very profound. Ladies and gentlemen, I end my story with the great world historic city of Liverpool. Liverpool was called into being as a junction for the landing, embarkation and storage of vast wealth exchanged between the North and Midlands of England and the overseas world. My story is the story of the rise and fall of empire, and no city symbolises the fall of empire with greater trauma than Liverpool. Liverpool grew rich on the African trade of the 17th and 18th century. It was the great slaving city, and from those riches it created more millionaires than anywhere else outside of London. The money flowed down to Liverpool, flowed to Manchester and Cheshire and Lancashire. And then in the 19th century, after the abolition of the trade in slaves, Liverpool becomes the export port for the workshop of the world, as we use our control of colonial markets to flood them with industrial produce. And Liverpool has the great trading and shipping connections. In olden times, it used to be said that all roads lead to Rome. Today, all seas lead to Liverpool, wrote one historian in 1907. There is no part of the globe, however remote, whose natives may not be met on the Liverpool landing stage. And this was part of the image of Liverpool. Liverpool was the New York of Europe. Liverpool was a cosmopolitan, enlightened, metropolitan city. This was a city of the world. So when, in the latter half of the 20th century, our export trade began to collapse, when we moved from empire to Europe, when we stopped, when we exchanged sugar cane for sugar beet, Liverpool found itself on the wrong side of history and the wrong side of geography. And the Toxteth, the Liverpool 8 riots of July 1981, after decades of deindustrialization, of decolonization, of political decisions, sees Liverpool reach its absolute nadir. And if we want to talk of the rise and fall of empire, it seems to me that Liverpool symbolizes, yes, it could be Glasgow, yes, it could be Hull, but Liverpool symbolizes that more than any other city. But that is not where my story ends, because across the former cities of the British Empire, one can also trace the impact of new rising powers. And one can also trace the impact of new rising powers here in the UK. And nowhere more so than in Liverpool. For having seen the end of the British Empire, Liverpool has decided that its fortunes lie with a rising new empire. Liverpool's civic leaders have concluded that regeneration lies with the renminbi. The city has twinned with Shanghai. It has dispatched Everton Football Club on a series of soft power friendlies. It has even spruced up its own Chinatown. And driving this Sino-Scouse collaboration is the Peel Group, which is hoping to revive the region's economy with a $10 billion investment in docks and regeneration. And here you see in this image, those of you who know Liverpool will know something's slightly wrong here. Here you will see a mocked-up image of what the future of Liverpool dockside should look once the Chinese money begins to flow. So here you see the Three Graces. Here you see the Museum of Liverpool. Here you see one of the worst buildings in Western Europe. And here you see the proposed new Shanghai Tower. And what all of this is about is Liverpool embracing a new empire and thinking how it, as a colonial city, can begin to make money out of a rising empire in the east. So what it wants are big water docking facilities. What it wants is an attractive place for Chinese investment. And so whereas once Liverpool exported the wares of the workshop of the world out to the world, now Liverpool is to be the sort of docking station of China and the other workshops of the world back into the UK. And I have to tell you, not everyone is happy. In 2010, the Wirral Society of Local Conservationists condemned those, quotes, who are dead set on restructuring the riverside entrance into the port of Liverpool in the style of Sydney, New York, or Shanghai. in that wonderful language of a regional conservation group, they suggested, quotes, "It is very feasible that many Wirilians will not like the idea of being Shanghaied. But new empires are rising, and their force, ladies and gentlemen, will be felt in a new generation of imperial cities across the globe." Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.